All right, so if you think about it, from the 1944 Democratic Convention, when Wallace was replaced by Truman, and as Lynn indicated, I mean, that shaped the entire post-war period, because while it didn't manifest itself immediately, as soon as Franklin Roosevelt died, you had an entire change in characteristic, certainly in terms of the Democratic Party, but because of the leading role of the United States, you had a change in the directionality of the entire world. I mean, in a sense, things like John Kennedy and, you know, other efforts to reverse, even Eisenhower, were essentially efforts to reverse a characteristic which had been set into motion by the replacement of Wallace, who represented the American system, by Truman, who represented the utopians, represented the synarchists, and so on. And the entire 60-year period, which encompasses all of our lives, looking at the lifespan of everybody in this room, well, Dorothy might have been ahead a few months or something, but in essence, which has covered all of our lives, was determined by that change in directionality, which was the replacement of by Truman of Henry Wallace. So here we, I mean, that's 1944. This is 2004. You're looking at a 60-year period of time, a 60-year period of time in which Lynn has essentially been waging, for much of it, a very lonely fight, and in the recent 30 years, not quite so lonely, but still a fight against that directionality toward bestiality. He's been waging this fight, and he's been waging this fight in the domain of ideas, with apparently very little of what most people consider the trappings of power. We sure don't have much money. Temporarily, we got a little bit. But we sure don't have much money. We don't have a whole lot of people. We don't have reputation in terms of public opinion and so on. Yet Lynn has been fighting a battle in a domain of ideas which is now very, very close to actually defeating the ideology and the policies of the utopians, of the synarchists, which has dominated the last 60 years. I want to look at Plato's life from precisely that same 60-year-long perspective, because ironically, from his probable first meeting with Socrates in 407 to his death is a 60-year period of time. And it represents this exactly the same quality of fight. That is, an individual who is fighting in the domain of ideas, fighting on a plane which very, very few other people in his society were fighting on, recruiting a relatively small group of people to join with him in that fight. The domain of ideas that he's functioning in, that he's fighting in, is, as Lynn has come to describe it, the domain of the complex domain, the domain where the tension between the visible universe and the invisible universe, where the universal principles actually lie, allow the human mind to make creative breakthroughs, to increase its power over the universe. In precisely the same way, and it's especially extraordinary now in the last 3 years since we've seen the growth of the LaRouche Youth Movement recruited in this way, to go back and look at what Plato did, what the founding of the Academy was, the nature of his political fights, the comparison between the two is extraordinary, right down to the fact that you're dealing with a 60-year-long period. Perhaps it's not quite so extraordinary because, as Lynn has stressed, the battle for ideas has a generational quality, and you're essentially dealing with two generations when you're dealing with a 60-year period of time. With Lynn, the World War II generation, our generation, and now we're bringing the third generation to bear. And essentially, Plato succeeds in doing the same thing, with the third generation being brought to bear, being Alexander the Great, at the end of this process, in a sense, which, while temporarily successful, ultimately was overwhelmed again. But nonetheless, you can see this question of the generations. So what I want you to do is, I mean, many of you know Plato through his dialogues, but to actually look at Plato from the standpoint of his political organizing is quite extraordinary. So what I'm going to do is walk you through Plato's life and the key people that he recruited, that he worked with, and so on, in this endeavor to address a similar disastrous directionality that his civilization, Athens in this case, Greek civilization, was taking. The battle he waged in exactly the same way, using exactly the same kind of recruiting people to the same fight to understand the complex domain. So Plato is born in, I've got some dates on the board, and we're going to try not to trip on John. You're going to have to let this be a little more mobile.
Oh,
there
okay.
You go. Okay. Plato was born in 428, and he meets Socrates probably in 407, and of course Socrates is killed. In 399. Now, if you remember from the previous class that I taught, which will also be the subject of an upcoming Fidelio, the period of time in which Plato comes to young adulthood, meeting Socrates in 407 at the age of 20, watching his execution in 399 at the age of 28, I mean, this is a period of the absolute complete destruction of Athens. They had allowed themselves to be drawn into the world of sophistry, the world of opinion, the world of manipulation, and so on, and were hence manipulated into the disastrous Peloponnesian War. And by the time of Socrates' death, Athens had gone completely mad. And it was madness of a quite psychedelic type. That is, you had madness embodied in the radical democracy, you had madness embodied in the tyranny. It was no one particular form of government which embodied the madness. It was an entire outlook which had driven the entire population insane. And in fact, Plato discusses this in his seventh letter, which is the most autobiographical letter of all of them. There's many arguments that most of the letters are spurious and so on. I mean, the basis for rejecting most of them is completely academically idiotic. But be that as it may, everybody does admit that the seventh letter is almost certainly Plato's and is completely autobiographical. And what he describes in there, the problem that he was confronted with, because remember, he came from a political family. His mother traced her lineage back to Solon. His uncle and cousin, Car's second cousin, Charmides and Critias, were members of the 30 Tyrants, which was the 404 grouping, which was placed in power by the Spartans after Athens lost. They were killed in the overthrow of the 40 Tyrants. He himself stated that he intended to enter politics, but when he saw what politics did to Socrates, the greatest man of all history, he decided this was not the life for him. And the way he put it in this letter is, he said, "Consequently, although at first I was filled with an ardent desire to engage in public affairs, when I considered all this and saw how things were shifting about anyhow in all directions, I finally became dizzy. And although I continued to consider by what means some betterment might be brought about, not only in these matters, but also in the government as a whole, yet as regards political action, I kept constantly waiting for an opportune moment, until finally, looking at all the states which now exist, I perceived that one and all they are badly governed, for the state of their laws is such as to be almost incurable, without some marvelous overhauling and good luck to boot. So, in my praise of the right philosophy, I was compelled to declare that by it one is enabled to discern all forms of justice, both political and individual. Wherefore, the classes of mankind will have no cessation from evils until either the class of those who are right and true philosophers attains political supremacy, or else the class of those who hold the power in the state becomes, by some dispensation of heaven, really philosophic." So with the death of Socrates and with what he has seen happening throughout his entire young life at that point, he walks away from politics as usual and embarks upon this question of how a state, perhaps by the dispensation of heaven, can become really philosophic. Now, what Plato and most of Socrates' associates did immediately after Socrates' execution is they got out of there. There's a place, I believe, north of Greece, Megara. I think it's north of Greece. Yeah. West. Where probably Plato, but certainly some of the other people we're familiar with, like Cebes and Simmias from the Phaedo dialogue, went to the home of another philosopher named Euclides for a while. Plato may have gone there, he may have not gone there. Diogenes Laertes, though, then says that Plato embarks on an extensive international trip, and it's obvious what he's looking for, because the trip is very much grounded in the hotbeds of Egyptian scientific and mathematical thought. According to Diogenes Laertes, the first place he goes is Cyrene, Egypt, which is where our friend Theodorus from the Theaetetus dialogue comes from. Cyrenaica, of which the capital city is Cyrene, is in, don't move, John, I think we're okay, is right about somewhere here in Libya. I can't remember exactly where. But it's a Greek colony in Egyptian territory, essentially. Herodotus discusses its founding extensively. In the earlier century, the century of Pythagoras and Thales and Solons, in the middle of the 500 BCs, the pharaoh of Egypt, who liberates Egypt from the Persians, is Amasis. And Amasis was so enamored of Greek learning that he married a Cyrenaican Greek for his wife. So this was one of the key crossroads in terms of Greek-Egyptian kind of activity. Lynn's been referencing it more and more in some of his recent writings. After that, he then travels to Italy. And of course, Italy is where Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans in the previous century had established their Pythagorean community in Croton, which is right around here. So Plato travels there, and according to Philolaus, he meets with, according to Diogenes Laertes, he meets with Philolaus, who is probably the only, I would call him, second or third generation Pythagorean, sort of like one of the last well-known Pythagoreans after the Pythagorean community is wiped out. He's a generation after that, but he's one of the key transmitters of Pythagorean ideas. Plato meets with him on this trip. Then, according again to Diogenes Laertes, he travels to Egypt, back to Egypt. So he goes back down here. So he's gone from here to here, back down here to Egypt. He does this apparently in the company of Eudoxus, whom we'll meet later, as one of the key figures in the academy and one of the key political organizers, along with Plato. Now during this period of time, when you can almost say that Plato is on a fact-finding mission, that is, recognizing what has gone wrong with Athens, recognizing that in a sense there has to be a revolution in philosophy, deeper developments in terms of man's power over the universe. He where does he go? He goes to the key Egyptian Pythagorean areas that exist in the world at the time. Now, against the backdrop of this, while Plato was traveling internationally, the battle against the Persians had not been completely abandoned with the destruction of Athens. The venue changed for a period of time. And reasons which it's not worth going into detail at the moment, the person who becomes the head of Sparta during this period of time Agesilaus becomes one of the key people who starts working with Xenophon and others to resume the battle against Sparta, against Persia, rather. So what is happening against the backdrop of Plato's entire life is the effort to once again resume Greece's historic role as the nation which had defeated the Persians at the Battle of Marathon, at the Battle of Salamis 100 years earlier. It was the abandonment of that mission to defeat this oligarchical bastion that really spelled the retreat of Athens from its actual mission. So I'm not going to try and go through the history of all of that, but what you will find is that Plato's activities throughout this period of time continue to intersect and very probably were involved in leading the efforts to launch the fight anew against the Persians, drive them out of Ionia, drive them out of Egypt, drive them out of the various strongholds that they actually held. So he returns to Athens after this first trip abroad, which is obviously very extensive. He's abroad for almost a decade. And then very, very shortly, this is 399 to 388, and is obviously not back in Athens very long, and he takes off again. This is his first trip to Italy, which is, I'm moving, John, don't worry. His first trip to Sicily. Well, it's actually to Italy and to Sicily in this case. And the trip to Italy is where he first meets with Archytas. Now, apparently Cicero, in one of his works, references the importance of Plato's first meeting with Archytas in Tarentum, which is right here. No, it's in the boot of Italy. Yeah. It's also where Michelle is from. What Cicero says is that this visit was formative in terms of Plato's deepening of his ideas about both the immortality of the soul and obviously all the questions relating to number, geometry, harmony, astronomy, and so on. I mean, basically the Pythagorean corpus of knowledge is when he begins to be introduced to this. I mean, this poses an interesting way of looking at conceptually when he actually wrote the dialogues. It's actually a lot easier to place the dialogues historically. That is, when did he place them historically? You know, we know he wrote certain things in 430, to be placed in 432 as dramas, to be placed in 404 and so on. It's much less clear when he actually wrote the dialogues. However, if you look at this meeting with Archytas, coming off of the heels of the previous trip with Philolaus and so on, but especially the meeting with Archytas, if Cicero's assessment is to be taken seriously, you can see a different. There's certainly a dividing line in terms of what you might call the dialogues, which focus heavily on Socrates. Socrates' dialogue, the life of Socrates, and so on. And then other dialogues where you begin to get much more deeply into these kinds of Pythagorean questions, like the Theaetetus, the Meno, obviously the Timaeus, and so on. It poses an interesting question in terms of the Phaedo, I think, in terms of the immortality of the soul. Did it come, is it written at the same time as the first three of the life of Socrates? Or is it perhaps written later on, after he's made this trip? Because it's fairly clear that the early things, like the Credo, the Apology, and so on, are from the very, very early period, possibly while he was still traveling in that very, very first trip. What you see, yeah, it's obvious from the content, there's no dating. It's obvious from the content of the dialogues that, you know, you're introducing new kinds of ideas, which you don't find so much in the Apology, the Credo, the Euthydemus, or the Euthyphro, rather, and so on. Beyond that, there's certain other, I mean, there's all sorts of books written about when these dialogues were written. You know, we're going to have to go back and probably rewrite them from the standpoint of understanding the actual ideas, as opposed to one lunatic who would give Strauss great pride, who dates the when the dialogues, the various dialogues were written on certain grammatical similarities. You know, he uses this grammatical phrase, and therefore that's from this period, and so on. So enough of that. But after he meets with Archytas, I should say about Archytas, I mean, besides what we well know in terms of his breakthrough, his discovery of how to double the volume of the cube, he was involved in constant work in these kinds of areas. Some people might remember the class Ted gave a couple of years ago on various things that Archytas was working on, including a flying machine, where he used the pressure involved with water and boiling something in a little bird so that it created steam coming out and it caused the bird to flap its wings or something like that. But that was probably for fun. Archytas was obviously one of the key geniuses of the period, but he was also a political leader. He was a political leader of Tarentum. He was the general, the elected general of Tarentum during the whole key period that Plato was active in Italian politics for 7 years in a row, which was extraordinary because the law in the city had it that you could only be elected once. And so they just suspended the law and kept electing him and electing him and electing him and electing him. He also then, at various points, traveled to Sicily at Plato's request to intervene into the situation there. And that was the second place Plato went after meeting Archytas in Tarentum. He travels to Syracuse. Now, at this time, you know, in the first decades of this century, really the first half of this century, this is the richest, most powerful Greek city in the world. I mean, Athens is a wreck, and there really isn't all that much, you know, after the Peloponnesian War. The Ionian city-states had been, you know, conquered by the Persians many, many, many times. Syracuse was, in a sense, like, you know, like a United States in the sense that it had never been invaded, it had never been conquered. And Plato saw this obviously as a crucial place where maybe he could do what he had said in that letter, which is either create a right and true philosopher who attains political supremacy, or else recruit the class of those who hold power to become, by some dispensation of heaven, really philosophic. So his first target for doing this is the existing leader of Syracuse, Dionysius I. Now, I don't remember how many months it took me to figure out the difference between Dionysius I, Dion, and Dionysius II. Just so we can maybe all get it straight all at once, because the first time I read the letters, I was completely confused. Dionysius I is the father. Dionysius II, who's not born yet at this point, or is just born, is the son of Dionysius I. Dion is the brother-in-law of Dionysius I, and therefore the uncle of Dionysius II. When Plato goes to Syracuse for the first time, his intention is to recruit Dionysius I, to try and turn him into something like a philosopher king. But what in reality happens is he meets Dion, who is only 20 years old at the time. And Dion becomes really one of his closest collaborators, along with Archytas, along with Eudoxus, who we'll meet again. Dion really becomes where Plato places a great amount of hope in terms of the second option, or the first option, training somebody in the philosophical outlook and then they become the leader of their country. But at the same time, he's still working on the guys who actually have power and seeing if he can recruit them as well. So this was his first effort, is to recruit Dionysius I. But again, as I say, he meets Dion, and they form a lifelong friendship. Plato's initial efforts, however, to recruit Dionysius I fail. And at a certain point, Dionysius gets fed up with Plato. Well, let me put it from a different standpoint. In the court in Syracuse, surprise, surprise, you have a lot of sophists. You've got enemy agents in the court of Syracuse. Philistus is one of the key sophist philosophers who's in there poisoning the well all the time. There's another guy who shows up a little later called Aristippus. But, I mean, it's literally these guys are trained sophists, and their purpose is to ensure that Dionysius I does not in any way, shape, or form get recruited to the Platonic or Republican outlook. So they basically stir up all sorts of trouble for Plato. And Dionysius I decides this guy is a problem, and Dionysius I is about to sell Plato into slavery and has basically turned him over to somebody whose next step is going to be to sell him into slavery, and that's going to be the end of that. We're never going to hear from Plato again. Dion intervened. He intervened with the help of a Cyrenaican named Amneris, who actually came up with the money to buy Plato out of the clutches, buy Plato before he's sold into slavery. When Plato then gets back to Athens, because he obviously decides this is a good time to get out of Syracuse, when Plato gets back to Athens, as Diogenes Laertes has it, they try and pay Amneris back the money, which he put up to get Plato out of slavery. And instead, Amneris says, no, keep it, and found your academy. So this is when, this is when the academy is founded. He returns to Athens. And we even have musical interludes. he returns to Athens and founds the academy. So he's about 41 years old at the time. I mean, I always find it kind of fun thinking about Plato comparing it to Lynn, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, how old is Lynn when he first begins to, you know, launch the embryo of the organization in 66, 67? He's in his early to mid-40s. You know, it's essentially the same kind of period of time. So one of the things I pose to the youth out on the West Coast is to take the various figures that are involved in this political fight, Archytas, we'll see Eudoxus in a minute, and others, you know, and look at the body of their work such as we can look at it. I mean, in few cases do we have actual extant writings from them. In a lot of cases, you've got ancient sources describing their breakthroughs and so on. But to actually realize that all of this was part of one political battle and kind of look at it afresh from that standpoint. What one of the ancient historians said is that what Plato posed to all of his serious students at the academy was the following problem, and that the serious ones were all to work on this. What is the simplest mathematical formula to describe the motions of the heavenly bodies, which are consistent with the observations that we make? In other words, what Kepler is working on two millennium later, essentially, is the problem that is consuming many people at the academy. I'm just going to go through some of the people in the academy without trying to really do justice to... Huh? About 387, 388, 87, 387, when he returns from the first trip to Sicily. Whoops. We got tangled up, John. We succeeded. There we go. So Eudoxus is somebody who is just as politically active as Plato. He's probably with Plato way back in that first trip to Egypt that I talked about in the 390s and so on. He returns to Egypt later in 361, I'll come to that in a bit, when there's a revolt among various satraps of Persia. Egypt, various Ionian satraps are in revolt against Persia. Eudoxus seems to be the person in Egypt coordinating the operations in Egypt. When Plato is in Sicily for his second visit, which we'll come to, he's running the academy during Plato's second visit. So he's obviously considered one of Plato's most trusted collaborators. And what are the things that he's working on? I mean, when you think of Lynn's emphasis on the question of spherics and astronomy and so on, but the entire Egyptian Pythagorean-based approach to geometry from the standpoint of spherics, the different things Eudoxus is working on, and Larry and other people may, you know, have something to offer at the end during the discussion period in terms of more details. This is just a gloss. You know, working on the sphericity of the Earth, working on various kinds of celestial globes. Obviously, he's working on Plato's Kepler problem. Spherics, showed the sphericity of the Earth by showing that the altitude of stars change depending on your latitude, and so on. He came up with an approved approximation for the length of the year. You know, we know him for the method of exhaustion in terms of pushing an idea to its to a certain limit, and so on. So that's Eudoxus. You also had at the academy our friend Theaetetus, whom the dialogue, of course, is named after. The father of solid geometry, such as we have a written tradition of it, as we see in the Theaetetus, the whole question of incommensurability. Apparently, he came up with a a conception of concentric circles, intersecting concentric circles, as his answer to Plato's question of describing how the heavenly bodies are, what is actually causing their motions. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Eratosthenes or somebody actually gives us a discussion of how he actually did it, which would be a lot of fun to look at. One of the other people at the academy was Heraclides of Pontus, and it said he may have discovered the axial revolution of the Earth and the revolutions of Venus and Mars. And then we have Menechmus, who is a pupil of Eudoxus. And he, of course, ends up being the tutor of Alexander the Great, and, you know, one of the earliest in terms of works on conic sections and so on. So, but I mean, when you just think about, and then, of course, back in Sicily, you've got, or in Italy, you've got Archytas. But these people are engaged in an intense political fight, especially Eudoxus, Plato's nephew, Speusippus, who ends up running the academy after Plato dies, is politically traveling with him a lot of the time. So you've got a combat university on wheels. I mean, it's not just an academy in a nice grove. You have a combat university on wheels. Plato spends pretty much the next 20 years, as far as we can tell, in Athens, establishing the academy, working on these problems, and so on. Then several things intersect right around 370 BC. First of all, the alliance which the Persians had hooked up between Thebes, Corinth, and Athens, which had succeeded in really neutralizing Athens, pulling Athens into a really bad bunch of people, it broke up. And there was the possibility for Athens and Sparta to get together again in an attack on Persia. So you had that beginning potential shift. And then in 367, Dionysius I dies. Dion, his brother-in-law, Plato's protege, Dion calls Plato back to Sicily. So this is the second trip to Sicily. And now the leader of Sicily is Dionysius II, the son of Dionysius I. Dion, Plato's protege, is obviously playing a very significant role because Dion at this time is, the generations are fun. Plato's 60 at this time, Dion's 40, and Dionysius II is 20. So he's just a young whippersnapper. He doesn't know much of anything. He's pulled every which way. Dion pulling him one way, the sophists in the court pulling him another way. So Plato and Dion says, all right, now we've got this young man as leader of Sicily. Let's give it a shot. You know, let's see if we can recruit him. He says he's interested in philosophy.
This is 20 years later.
This is in 367. This is the second trip. The first trip was 387. Second trip is 367. So Plato takes up the challenge and returns at the age of 60 to Sicily. But the sophists, led by Philistus, again, carries out all sorts of maneuvering and convinces Dionysius II to expel Dion. So Dion is forced to leave Sicily at that point. Plato sticks around, though, sticks around for at least a year after Dion is and Dion, when he's expelled, goes to Athens, takes up residence at the academy, and becomes part of the academy. But Plato tries to organize Dionysius II. Among other things, he asks him for land and settlers someplace on Sicily. So, you know, there's another option. If you can't recruit this guy, maybe I can go maybe I can found an America someplace and actually set something up myself. But he doesn't get all that far. And he returns to Athens in 366. But second trip to Sicily, the first trip with Dionysius II, he's nonetheless trying very, very hard to continue to recruit Dionysius II. And this is where a lot of the letters that are written to Dionysius are from the period after he returns to Athens, after his second trip to Sicily, the first trip to try and recruit Dionysius II. And everything he's trying to organize Dionysius II around is Pythagorean knowledge. In letter 13, he says, well, you say that you're interested in philosophy, so by way of helping you toward this end, I'm now sending you some of the Pythagorean works and of the divisions, actually, diaresis, which is the various harmonic proportions and so on. And also, we arranged at that time a man of whom you and Archytas, if Archytas has come to your court, may be able to make use of. His name is Helicon. He's a native of some place I've never heard of. And he's a pupil of Eudoxus, and exceedingly well-versed in all his doctrines. It were best, then, if you have any leisure at all, to take lessons from him, in addition to your other studies in philosophy. But if not, get someone else thoroughly taught, so that you may learn from him when you have leisure, and therefore make progress and gain glory, that so the benefit you gain from me may still continue. So that's letter 13 to Dionysius II. Then in another letter, letter number 2, and I don't know who the hell numbered these. Because whatever convention somebody used to number them succeed in confusing you absolutely massively, because they are not in chronological order. In letter number 2, he talks about having sent Dionysius a spheron, a globe, probably a celestial orrery. And he says, as to the globe, there is something wrong with it. So it's obviously not just a circle. It's probably a device having to do with the heavens. And Archidemus will point out to you what's wrong with it when he arrives. But in the meantime, you know, you can begin to study it. Then he says also at the end of this same letter, 13, this translation is hysterical. He says, keep well and study philosophy and exhort thereto all the other young men. And greet for me your comrades at the game of ball. Okay. I mean, I like baseball too, but is that really what Plato is saying to Dionysius II? No, because the word isn't ball. It isn't comrades at the game of ball. The word is fellow spherists. So, which they admit in the footnote, by the way. I mean, they're perhaps embarrassed enough. In fact, the footnote says the Greek word fellow spherists, which is simply sousphairistas, suggests a play on the double meaning of sphere as ball and globe. So the real meaning may be fellow astronomers. And actually, they do it again in another translation. He says, you bade me be, this is also letter three, you bade me be educated before I did all, this is Plato saying to Dionysius, this is what you said to me. You bade me be educated before I did all these things or else not to do them. And Plato says, well, I replied that your memory was excellent. And you, Dionysius II, then said, did you mean educated in land measuring or what? Anyone want to guess what land measuring is? Geometry. The word is geometry. I mean, geometry is geometro, metris. And I have a geometro. I never thought of that. but the word is geometry. And, you know, to translate this as land measuring, I mean, these guys really do go out of their way to obscure what's really going on. But maybe they had a geometro. but this is, you know, this is what Plato is still endeavoring to communicate, to educate Dionysius II, and so on. Now, during this period here, when he's back in Athens, basically in this period here, he's in Athens, 366. I'll just fill this in. This will be his third trip. But in this period is when you have what's called the Satraps' Revolt. And that's when there's a concerted effort involving a lot of people connected to Plato. In Ionia, which is over here. In Egypt, here. Well, pretty much there, Ionia and Egypt, to revolt from the Persians, who were in control in many, many parts of the area at the time. This is a period of time when Eudoxus goes back to Egypt and helps organize the Egyptian wing of this revolt against the Persians and so on. You know, so again, you see how politically active everybody is. And in 362, Plato is recruited in part by Archytas to come back to Sicily one more time and try once more to actually recruit Dionysius II. Archytas himself has gone to Sicily, as that early letter implies, to work on actually trying to recruit Dionysius II. Plato goes for two reasons. You know, this he says in the seventh letter, he says, this probably will be my last chance to recruit somebody who is in power to be a philosopher. He also goes back because Dionysius II says that if you come back, I'll settle Dion's affairs. Because Dionysius II's been a real bastard. You know, he's taken all of Dion's land and possessions. When he expelled Dion, he kept Dion's wife and family behind and forced his wife to marry somebody else and, you know, so on and so forth. So Plato feels he owes a debt to Dion, so he goes back as well because Dionysius II says, if you come back and you be my court philosopher, I'll make things right with Dion. So Plato goes back, even though by this time he's 66 years old and really doesn't feel like jumping on a ship and, you know, sailing around the Mediterranean and so on. He agrees to go back because of Archytas's urgings and because of Dion's because he wants to settle things with Dion. And he probably goes back with his own nephew, Speusippus, at this one. Some of the letters refer to the fact that Speusippus is with him as well. So again, I mean, this question of the academy is not some, it's not academic. You know, it's very, very much politically motivated. And this is the trip where Dionysius II, whipped up by the same sophists who've been at it the whole period of time, basically holds Plato in house captivity and in a very physically dangerous situation because the mobs are being whipped up and they could probably get their hands on Plato at any time. And this is the time, this is when Archytas intervenes to save Plato. And this is, according to Diogenes Laertes, Archytas's letter to Dionysius, urging him to release Plato. He says, "We, being all of us the friends of Plato, have sent to you two people in order to take the philosopher away by the terms of the agreement made with you. You will do well to remember that the zeal with which you urged us all to secure Plato's coming to Sicily, determined as you were to persuade him and to undertake, amongst other things, responsibility for his safety so long as he stayed with you and on his return. Remember this, too, that you set great store by his coming, and from that time had more regard for him than for any of those at your court. If he has given you any offense, it behooves you to behave with humanity and restore him to us unhurt. By doing so, you will satisfy justice and at the same time put us under an obligation." And that succeeds, and Dionysius allows Plato to leave Sicily and return to Athens for the last time. It's also shortly after this that the satrap's revolt collapses. But still Plato, I mean, despite everything that Dionysius II has put him through, is still trying to work with him. So one of his letters, he says to him, watch out for Philistius, this guy's bad news. And he reminds Dionysius II that the most important thing that he had given to Dionysius II in terms of lawmaking was preludes. And this is a beautiful echo from the Laws, because when you read the Laws, you know, you get through about the first five books, if I remember correctly, which are these very detailed laws, you know, how much land, who gets to do this, you know, various laws for adjudicating crimes of all sorts of kinds and so on. You're sitting there reading it and reading it and reading it. And then he comes to a point and he says, but we forgot something. We forgot something before we embarked on this whole discussion. We forgot the most important part about a constitution, the prelude, which is the concept of a preamble, which is why you write a constitution. And that the prelude he develops is that you are organizing your society for the good. So what he says to Dionysius is, he said, I took part in a few of your political acts at first when I thought I was doing some good by it, and I gave a fair amount of attention to the preludes of the Laws. But I am told that some of you afterwards revised my preludes. But again, nonetheless, this is after his third return to Athens, second return from meeting with Dionysius II, still trying to actually organize the guy. But at a certain point, it's really clear that it's not going to work. And Dion convinces, well, I'm not sure who convinces who, but Dion decides to return to Sicily and overthrow Dionysius II. So he raises forces to do so. He succeeds in doing so. Dionysius II just escapes to somewhere. But what happens, I mean, it's like a microcosm of what happens in Athens earlier, because the sophists are still afoot. And on two different occasions, Dion is overthrown by the mob, by the sophists, and then they realize what a wreck they've made of things, and they ask him to come back, and then they overthrow him again, and then he comes back again, and then he's ultimately assassinated.
This is all like 2 years.
Yeah. Well, in a 2 year period of time. I mean, it's the same kind of madness you see in Athens by 406, 405, 404, which is you have a population which has got no concept of anything other than mob opinion, essentially, and can be whipped up by whoever gives the best speech. So Dion is assassinated in 354 He returned in 357. He launched the expedition, took over in 356, and was assassinated by 354. And that's when Plato writes the seventh letter to the friends of Dion, explaining everything that's happened, what role he played with both Dionysiuses and so on. Plato dies in 347, so that's 7 years after the assassination of Dion. But again, if you want to think then of the third generation, with Plato as the first, Dion as the second, what is your third generation? Your third generation is Alexander the Great, because he's born in 356 BC. He leads the expedition against the Persians in 334 and succeeds in crushing the Persians. But of course, he's assassinated in 323. And then by the assassination of Archimedes, basically 100 years later, in 212, this entire tradition, and remember, as I mentioned earlier, Alexander was a pupil of Menechmus. You know, we all know the Aristotle fraud in terms of being a pupil of Aristotle. So therefore, this entire Platonic Pythagorean tradition, which was really launched in 600 BC with Solon, the 570s by Pythagoras, and so on, you know, is the substance of a 60-year-long battle in terms of Plato's life, comes to an end with the assassination of Archimedes, and we don't bring it back to life until the Renaissance with the rediscovery of Plato, and you don't really bring it back to life until Lynn founded the LaRouche Youth Movement 4 years ago on exactly this kind of program. Now, I want to take a look at a fascinating concept that Plato develops in the seventh letter. I happen to be rereading the seventh letter about 3 days after I got to sit through Bruce's five-hour class in Los Angeles a month or so ago when he was out there. So all of these ideas, you know, were percolating in my head. And as I sat there and read this section of the seventh letter, I got to a certain point of it, and I said, I think you have a germ idea here of the infinitesimal in terms of the way he develops something. So I just want to walk you through this section of the seventh letter. You know, and people can play around with this idea. This is the section where he's discussing how Dionysius II pretends he's a philosopher and claims to have written a philosophical tract on Plato's writings. And Plato says, first of all, I know he doesn't have the disposition for philosophy, because the only way you can have a disposition for philosophy is if you decide if you love philosophy and your life has to be ordered and moderate and sober so that your mind can work on these ideas. And this does not describe Dionysius II. Mm-hmm. But he also says, this is where he says, you can't write my philosophy down. What he says is there does not exist, nor will there ever exist, any treatise of mine dealing therewith. For it does not at all admit of verbal expression like other studies, but as a result of continued application to the subject itself and communion therewith. More musical interludes, I like it.
Preludes and interludes.
For it does not admit at all of verbal expression like other studies, but as a result of continued application to the subject itself and communion therewith, it is brought to birth in the soul on a sudden. As light that is kindled by a leaping spark, and thereafter it nourishes itself. Now, David knows this.
Can you explain where on the sudden?
Thank you, David. This is one of my favorite words in Greek. It's a word exapnos, where it means it's actually the same root that apnea comes from. Sorry, Rachel. which means to stop. And with the X in front of it, it's a kind of explosive, you know, stopping. In the Parmenides, Plato does something beautiful with this word. He takes the adverb form of it, suddenly, and he puts a the in front of it. So it's the suddenly, which Jonathan translated as singularity. But it's this concept of something happening, in a sense, in almost no time. But we'll come back to that idea in a minute. But that's... Wait till we get to the rest of this. But, you know, this, but he, in introducing this entire discussion that we're about to go through, you know, he starts out, he has this image of it brought to birth in the soul on a sudden as light that is kindled by a leaping spark, and thereafter it nourishes itself. So then he actually walks you through the method by which you can cause these creative singularities to take place. As a way, as well, also of showing that you really, it's between the notes. I mean, he's giving you a discussion of a process of between the notes right here. So what he says is every existing existence has three things by which knowledge of it can be found. Now, he says the knowledge itself is the fourth thing, and the existence itself is the fifth thing. But to get the knowledge, he says, there are three things which by which you acquire the knowledge. The first is its name. And he uses as an example a circle. So the name of a circle is a circle. The second thing is its definition. And, you know, for example, he describes the circle as, you know, that which is equidistant from the center everywhere. And so on. That's its definition, which he says is composed of names and verbs. And then he says the third thing is an image of the object. So, you know, you can draw an image of a circle. That's not bad. You know, you can use a lathe to create an image of a circle and so on. But that image, of course, is something which comes into existence and then decays. It's a physical object. So these are the three things, the name, the definition, and the image. It says the knowledge, therefore, then he says, forth comes knowledge and intelligence and true opinion. Intelligence here is nous, by the way. So forth comes knowledge, and you could say mind and mind of, and true opinion regarding these objects. And these we must assume to form a single whole which does not exist in vocal utterance or in bodily forms, but in the soul. So even though you have the name, you have the definition, you have the image, all of these things are in your visible domain. You know, you can see it, you can hear it because you're talking about it, you can touch it if you've actually lathed the circle and so on. It's between those notes that you actually find the knowledge knowledge of it. And he says, and of these four, knowledge and then these other three, it's the fourth which most nearly in kinship and similarity is to the fifth. That is, the actual circleness is most approached by this knowledge, which is this between the notes idea of these other sense perceptions and so on. And the rest, the other three, are further removed from this.
What is the fifth?
The fifth is the circleness itself. Not the image of a circle, but circleness.
And not the knowledge of it.
And not the knowledge of it, but circleness itself. I mean, I sort of was thinking about it from the standpoint, I mean, of, you know, let's torture ourselves for a minute. How many people remember calculus? There's your curve, right? You know, and how many of you, as I did, asked your calculus teachers to explain to you what calculus was? And my aunt was a calculus teacher, God bless her, but, you know, whenever I asked her what calculus was and what it was for, she'd say, well, you draw these things, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller, and as you get to infinity, and so on. And what is, in your, you know, I mean, most of us gagged on calculus. You know, I mean, just about anybody in this room who went through calculus started to go crazy at right about that point. Because your mind is rejecting this idea that something which is clearly linear in any way, shape, or form has anything to do with a curve, is going to give you an actual understanding of the essence, the existence of that process of the curve. And in fact, Plato addresses this because he says, when you're taking the physical circle that you've drawn. He says, every one of the circles which are drawn in geometric exercises or are turned by the lathe are full of what is opposite to the fifth, its essence, since it is in contact with the straight everywhere. So, I mean, he just threw, you know, Eulerian calculus right out the window, you know, in that little section. And so what he then develops a little more fully, he says, what the soul is trying to understand is the essence, not these qualities of name or definition and so on. He says, the main point is that there are two separate things, the real essence and the quality. And the soul seeks to know not the quality, but the essence. And each of the four proffers to the soul, either in word or in concrete form, that which is not sought. And I was just thinking, Lynn just, in the Maritone's introduction, you know, where he says, the name given to the creative processes of the human mind, processes lacking an inferior species, was the soul, as argued in Plato's Socratic Dialogues. Soul, creative noetic powers of the human mind are coextensive notions, which is what he's saying right here. But then he actually develops a little bit further, and this is, echoes very much the end of the fifth book of the Republic, right before the cave parable, where Plato discusses how the paradoxes of sense perception provoke the mind to look at thought objects, to create thought objects. And he has that one line where he says, you look at ideas through ideas to achieve new ideas, essentially. And he that same process, which he describes a little earlier in that, he says, because how do you get to this question of the knowledge? How do you get, you know, even closer to the actual essence? He says, it is the methodical study of all of these stages, looking at the name, the definition, this, the paradoxes, and so on. It is the methodical study of all these stages, passing in turn from one to another, up and down, which with difficulty implants knowledge when the man is of a fine nature. And he said, for in learning of these essences, it is necessary to learn at the same time both what is false and what is true of the whole of these essences, and that through the most diligent and prolonged investigation, as I said at the commencement, is by means of the examination of each of these objects, comparing one with another, names and definitions, visions and sense perceptions, proving them by proofs and employing questionings and answerings that are void of envy. It is by such means, and hardly so, that there bursts out the light of intelligence and reason regarding each object in the mind of him who uses every effort of which mankind is capable. And again, he says, this is why you can't write my philosophy down, because it's this kind of process. And then the very last thing that he says, which is where you get this, again, this embryo of the idea of an infinitesimal. He says, for the writings of Dionysius were not meant as aids to memory, which some might argue, well, he wrote this stuff down so you could remember what he's trying, you know, remember this process. He says that can't be true, because there is no fear that anyone would ever forget these kinds of truths if once he grasps it with his soul, seeing that it occupies the smallest possible space. So, I mean, you know, you look at what he's gone through. First of all, this is something which only the soul and intelligence can understand. Secondly, it forms a single whole, as he said earlier. It doesn't exist in vocal utterances or in bodily forms. And it's something which is grasped by the soul, seeing that it occupies the smallest possible space. So, you know, when you think about this as the subject of what Plato and the Academy were working on, you know, 2,400 years ago, and look at where we are today, we're at the end of the same 60-year period, but this time I think we're going to come out a little better. So, that's it. We got time for a few minutes of questions. Tim?
What's the story about how so much of Plato was preserved? Because if you think about Archimedes, there's a lot got wiped out. A lot of these others have very little that got preserved. Obviously, there was some effort, I mean, some successful effort to have the entire corpus of Plato transferred.
Good question. Find out. I mean, I think we could do a lot more actually looking at the history of the Academy. I mean, I think that begins to address the question. But the people in the Academy, the first, second, third generations after Plato was gone, actually look at the body of work, look at the problems they were working on, and so on. And I suspect it's going to take you in part of an answer to that question. Judy?
Susan, I mean, along those lines, what you've been, one of the things you'd be looking at is that the generation after Alexander the Great, you know, is the famous nephew Pyrrhus, right? And he's fighting in Tarentum and Syracuse against the Romans in the north, and then Syracuse against the Phoenicians. And that's where he has his famous Pyrrhic victories, because militarily he's fighting a two-front war, but he can win militarily. But then there's some kind of, in both places, there's some kind of inside agentry against the Greek to turn these places over. And of course, Syracuse versus Phoenician, and then with the Punic War, you have the Romans coming in.
And then Jerry picks up.
Archimedes.
There's a lot of history when you simply start from the fact that it's the Pythagoreans and Plato, you know, versus Aristotle and the Persians. I mean, you know, you can look at Tate's two articles in Campaigner. They're very difficult to read because there's no passion in them. I mean, the facts are there. There's just no passion in them. So I read them about 5 times and dug the facts out. Started to read Cretons. Didn't quite get very far in it. I mean, there's a lot more work that needs to be done. In terms of filling in the history from the standpoint of, I mean, it's obvious, Tate, you know, to be quite blunt, most of the people who did the translation of the Timaeus didn't understand this. I mean, our translation of the Timaeus has got some very nice things in it, you know, like the composer, and it leaves a lot else to be desired because they didn't understand it from these ideas. So we got to go back and we got to look at all of this all over again. All right. Thank you.